Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to the show. And many of you may be joining us, maybe having imbibed certain substances last evening and are feeling slightly delicate today. Well, this is quite an appropriate show for you because we are talking about the calamitous failure of the so-called war on drugs, which was officially announced by President Richard Nixon half a century ago. And the consequences ever since are more people taking drugs than ever before. Drug use globally has exploded. So has problematic, what we could call problematic drug use, drug addiction, drug deaths. As well as that, we've seen mass incarceration, which has disproportionately fallen, disproportionately meant the incarceration of people of colour, particularly we can see in the United States and elsewhere, which have a big prison population, a massive black population who've been incarcerated by a racist policy, which is the war on drugs, which we will be talking about. We've seen the destabilisation of entire countries, from Mexico to the Philippines, with violent government policies, which again have killed so many people. We've seen people who need actual support and health not getting it, instead of it being treated as a health issue, being treated, of course, as a criminal issue. So the reason we're talking about it, and we've got lots of areas to talk about, is in Scotland, the government has suggested, or will be, has made it clear they will not be prosecuting some people who are found with Class A drugs on them. And instead, what will happen is they will get a caution, for example, a police warning or police warning of some description. So this opens up a conversation because you'd think if we had maybe an opposition which perhaps wanted to suggest an alternative workable policy, and I should make it clear, in Scotland, Scottish Labour is supporting the Scottish Nationalist Party in their policy shift. But Keir Starmer, the Labour leader, is not. And he's making it clear he does support the continued repressive drugs policies, which have failed on their own terms. Of course, it should also be noted that we have a Conservative government full of ministers who have openly, in some cases, made it clear they have themselves taken drugs in the past. So they enforce policies which disproportionately lock up young black men, whilst they themselves, of course, face no consequences, life-changing consequences for black people who are, when they are far more likely to be stopped and searched on suspicion of drugs, and if found with drugs, far more likely to suffer the justice system as a consequence. But of course, these cabinet ministers, white, disproportionately privileged men, they didn't face those consequences. It should also be noted that Dominic Cummings, mischievous elf that he is, has made it clear that currently, Tory politicians are taking drugs, and the Prime Minister is fully aware of that. So the hypocrisy is never ending. I should also say, having worked in the British media for 10 years, many journalists who will go out and use their poison pen often to support these policies, let's be honest, they themselves are partial as well to many of these substances. This is a debate riddled with painful hypocrisy. And many politicians know privately that this is a catastrophic failure. David Cameron, before he became Prime Minister, said that the war on drugs was a failure, and yet it tightened still further under his premiership. So we're talking about that today, but as well later we're talking about the case of Julian Assange. He faces extradition, and we will be talking about the LGB Alliance's conference, including a disco, which was, I think, the straightest thing I've ever seen in my entire life. We've got a lot to talk about, very eclectic topics. But also you can listen on the podcast. A lot of people just listen to on the podcast. Do subscribe on that. Press subscribe on the YouTube link as well. You get the videos. And the documentaries we're doing, like the Tory conference video we did, the Labour conference video we did. We have a video coming out, I think, next week now about wealth and power in Britain. Very much looking forward for that. That's supported by you, our team on Union Wages, on patreon.com/OwenJones84, and you can contribute whatever you want, even £3 a month or whatever. And that allows us to make those documentaries, do the podcast, do these videos, do lots of the interviews that we've got coming up as well. That is enough from me. I'm now going to bring in the esteemed Professor David Nutch, drug science, the former drug advisor, of course. And this is very important, who was sacked by the then Labour Home Secretary, Alan Johnson. And we'll explain, I'll let David explain. David, firstly, it's a big honour to have you. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Now, I mean, you must be sick to death of talking about this. This happened 12 years ago. Mm. And you made comments which are just basic objective facts, which the science... I'll let you explain what happened. What did you say and what happened? And in the meantime, because that happened, as I say, 12 years ago, how have things changed?
Well, things have got worse under the Tory government, but it was particularly irritating to be sacked by a Labour government. I've always had a quite strong left-wing socialist leanings, and it was a kind of rather particularly disappointing to be sacked by a Labour government, which actually to that point had been doing some relatively sensible things about treating drug addiction, but was still completely besotted with the war on drugs in terms of preventative measures. So, you know, that failed program that you highlighted initially. And why I was sacked? Well, the bottom line was I did two things wrong, according to Alan Johnson. The first was I dared to say that ecstasy was less harmful than horse riding. And that truly got the right-wing media and the establishment hysterical. And then a few months later, we looked at we did a detailed assessment of the different drug harms and came to the conclusion that alcohol was the most harmful drug in the UK, largely because it's one of the most widely used drugs, or is the most widely used drug. And so it has the biggest impact on society. When I went on the Radio for Today program and said, well, alcohol is clearly more harmful than LSD, the world went mad, because to actually talk about LSD in the same sentence as alcohol is like, you know, saying that the Pope is gay or something. It was truly, it was completely bizarre. I was on media all over the world. And then they sacked me because they said I wasn't supporting government policy. To which my response was, well, my job as a scientist is to direct the government to the right policy. And if the policy is self-evidently wrong, how can I support a policy that is clearly wrong? But that didn't matter because, of course, the drugs policies had never, ever been based on anything other than politics. That the concept of harm reduction, or the concept of a proportionate assessment of drug harms in terms of developing classifications, that's never, ever entered into the debate ever since we started to have serious approaches to drug policy, which probably started in about the 1860s. It's all been about politics with a large buttering of self-interest, particularly from drinks industry largely, and maybe some pharmaceutical companies.
So, and I should say as well, I forgot to say, for those who want to put questions to David Nutt, you super chat on YouTube and you can directly ask him. But Scotland... So the reason we're talking about this is in Scotland, they've announced that they won't prosecute some people who have Class A drugs on them for personal possession, basically. Yes. So how important is that? How much of a shift actually is that? And we'll come on after that. I'll ask you about Labour's position in Westminster, because it should be noted, as I said, there's a consensus north of the border between the Scottish Nationalist Party and the Scottish Labour Party. But that does not, of course, apply in Westminster.
So what the Scottish Lord Advocate has said is that it will be acceptable now, it will be policy, that people who are caught in possession of any drug, including, and that was the breakthrough Class A drugs, they can be dealt with administratively rather than through the criminal system. So they can be given a caution or encouraged into treatment or some other kind of educational based therapy. Now, this is a really remarkable advance because it is decriminalization. And we have known now for nearly 18 years that decriminalization is a good thing, particularly for people who use very dangerous Class A drugs. And we know that from the Portuguese experiment. And I suppose one simple statistic, which is so relevant to Scotland, in the 18 years of the Portuguese experiment, decriminalizing personal possession of all drugs and putting people into treatment or into other forms of help, has reduced deaths from opiates, from heroin largely, to a third of what they were when they brought in the policy 18 years ago. And in the UK, in the same period, our deaths have gone up by nearly doubled, over two thirds. So our policy of criminalizing drug users has actually massively increased deaths. And the reason for that is because many people who are using drugs are getting them on the black market. In fact, most are. And the black market is changing now. The black market is changing from heroin. It's moving more towards drugs like fentanyl, which are more toxic. And also decriminalizing drug use allows people to get back into work, get back into other forms of social engagement. Criminalizing them just puts them in prison, and where they essentially learn very little and often relapse to drug use in prison or as soon as they leave.
So Keir Starmer, the Labour leader, who of course formerly of the CPS, Crown Prosecution Service, he has made it clear that Labour in Westminster will not back the rollout of this approach to the rest of the UK. What does that tell us?
Well, there's different ways of looking at it. I mean, the simple way is to say that, you know, as a prosecutor, you know, you use a hammer analogy as a prosecutor, you know, if a prosecutor to a hammer, everything's a nail. To a prosecutor, everything needs to be prosecuted. So I think it would be quite challenging for him to admit he was wrong all those years he was putting people away. And let's just remember this. We have doubled our prison population in the last 40 years. And that doubling has all been due to drug crime. And other countries with more rational policies, like the Netherlands, are closing prisons because they don't put people with drug problems in prison at all. And the same with Portugal. Portugal has massively reduced its prison population through its decriminalization approach. So Starmer, partly, I guess, historic, that, you know, he believes that strong law is going to work. I think he's also probably frightened that it'll be an open up and a place for him or Labour to be easily attacked by, again, the right-wing press. It may just be he just doesn't know the evidence very well, but I'm sure there are people. I have spoken to the Fabian Society about this and other people in Labour. I'm sure there are people in Labour who could educate him if he wanted to listen. So I think this probably is politics again, as I said, you know, a few minutes ago. Drug laws are about politics. They're not about drugs. They're not about harms. They're about trying to establish your position with as a sort of moral authority in the country. And I think he's just, you know, continuing to, you know, go down the same misguided path that Brown and Blair and Cameron and all the others have done.
I mean, the thing, you know, as I noted before, David Cameron, before he became Prime Minister, I actually wrote a column a few years ago saying David Cameron was, you know, I agree with David Cameron. David Cameron was absolutely right in what he said before he became Prime Minister, right, that the so-called war on drugs was a failure. And then what happened under his premiership? The war on drugs only increased, further criminalisation of so-called illegal highs, for example. So you say, I mean, I don't know if you know from maybe what politicians, maybe you've spoke to politicians privately who will say one thing and then and not be willing to say it publicly. Is it your view that most politicians actually know this is a failure? I mean, they do actually have to see the consequences of the so-called war on drugs in their own constituencies. They see the impact. Do you think they know it's a failure? They just don't have the courage and they fear being monstered by the country's self-appointed moral guardians, the Daily Mail and so on.
Exactly. Well, yeah. So there are two things to say about that. The first is, until recently, until we got the really hardline Puritans in the Home Office, but certainly under the coalition and in under Labour, it was almost de rigueur that when a drug minister stood down, he put his hands up and said, mea culpa, I got it wrong. I mean, you know, I've got a series of quotes from a whole range of drug ministers saying they got it wrong. But under Theresa May and now, the drug ministers now, I think, are going back into the sort of Nixon mode of thinking that you can criminalize people yourself out of this problem. And that is absolutely ridiculous. You know, you elucidated it in your introduction. We have the war on drugs has failed. And just let me remind people, the war on drugs started as a way of Nixon getting elected. And we have perpetuated it in this country because we're so beholden to the US I mean, one thing people don't realize, until the 2016 Psychoactive Substances Act, every single drug law in Britain was made at the behest of America. The Misuse of Drugs Act, which took cannabis out of the medical pharmacopoeia, was forced through because of American pressure. The banning of cat a few years ago was under American pressure. Basically, they have made our drug laws, and it's time we stood up to them and said, no, we want to do things differently. And decriminalizing would be a good way forward.
Where are we at with psychedelics, for example?
Well, here's an interesting case in point. So these drugs were the first victim of the war on drugs. They were revolutionizing many aspects of therapy, particularly difficult to treat problems like addiction. I mean, paradoxically, these drugs are not addictive. People think they are because they're controlled in Schedule One, but they're not addictive. There were 6 trials of LSD to treat alcoholism. In the 1950s and 60s, they showed it's the most powerful treatment for alcoholism there's ever been. But they got sucked into the war on drugs, and for 50 years, they've not been studied. We've started using them again. It's proved very difficult, very painful, very expensive because of the bureaucracy. But we've shown, you know, they can have radical benefits in terms of people with severe depression. But getting to do the research is very difficult. It takes years to get permissions to do any study because they're still controlled drugs and they're still seen as very dangerous.
On that, David Barata asked, how much has the war on drugs stifled research into the potential medical applications of these drugs, cannabis and cancer, for example? So you just talked about the medical application of psychedelics, but more broadly.
Totally. The war on drugs is the worst censorship of research in the history of the world. 50 years, people have not been able to research the value of drugs like cannabis, psychedelics, MDMA. It is unbelievably regressive, because all these drugs were medicines and they still have medical value, but millions of people's lives have been essentially limited because we haven't been allowed to study them appropriately. It is the worst censorship of research in the history of the world.
We've mentioned obviously Scotland and Portugal. I mean, how much are there other bright examples in the world which people here can draw on to show that ending the war on drugs, there is an alternative? And what can we see in terms of the consequences of those approaches?
I mean, look at the Netherlands, the Netherlands coffee shop approach. They were the first country to stand up to the UN, which, of course, was an American hegemony, by saying we're going to allow people to smoke cannabis in coffee shops and have a small amount for personal possession. They didn't legalize cannabis. They just effectively decriminalized small amounts. And why did they do that? Because they wanted to separate the cannabis market from the heroin and cocaine market. Hugely successful intervention. They had much, much lower levels of young people using heroin than we had, and therefore many fewer deaths. So that's one really good example. Now, more recently, and a very exciting development has come through with the Oregon vote last November, when Oregon voted to basically decriminalize possession of magic mushrooms. And also they're proposing to set up a statewide facility for people to have access to that therapy if they need it. So given the fact that, the US, over 2/3 of Americans now have access to recreational cannabis and even more to medical cannabis. You know, America, through the statewide initiatives, is actually leading the world here now. And, you know, we should try to catch up because it's our patients that are suffering, not our people who are using the drug recreationally.
Very basic question, but this is just always what gets thrown at you whenever you talk about this. And I was on this panel show I often do the other day, talking about the failure of the so-called war on drugs, and the right wing panelists, let's put it that way, their default argument is always, essentially, you're going to turn children into drug addicts. Obviously, harm to children is always often the fallback of many different groups. We're talking about one later that has the same rhetoric. But that's what their argument is. Basically, if this will all of a sudden mean drugs are so widely available, as though you can't just text someone and get drugs within probably about half an hour, not that I'm encouraging everybody to do so, but if that's the idea, that basically this is going to lead to massive addiction amongst young people across the country, if we were to change the law, what would you say to that?
Well, I'll say the evidence is exactly the opposite. The evidence is in the Netherlands that fewer people use cannabis, and what they use is less harmful to them because they know what they're getting. And in Portugal, fewer people are dying from heroin. And the reality is, as you said, access to drugs has never been stopped by prohibition. And what has happened is that the banning of some drugs has led to the generation of markets for more harmful drugs. So now we have the most potent of all opiates, fentanyls, getting into the market for both for opiates and for other drugs, because it's a way of circumventing the ban on heroin. So it's been a wrong approach ever since it was brought in, which was back in the early 1900s.
I don't know if you know what's happening in Wales. Alexander Barnes asks, will Welsh Labour follow Scotland's lead? Mark Drakeford, who is the First Minister, seems relatively sensible. I was just wondering, I mean, on the Conservative benches, given they do have a massive majority, do we see any potential supporters? I mean, I remember during the Poppers debate, I forget his name.
That's right, Crispin Blunt. So Crispin is a very strong supporter of the attempts to rationalise the drug laws, particularly for medical research. Yes, he's very supportive. I suspect there are a lot of supporters, but they're not coming public yet, because until there's a move to change, you know, it's just a risk to them. But I think the patient argument for access to therapy and is the one that's going to eventually drive change in terms of access to psychedelics and MDMA, both of which are fascinating new forms of therapy. And to deny patients access to something when it, with a law that actually isn't affecting recreational use at all is completely iniquitous.
So just finally, I mean, what's the strategy now as you see it? Obviously, you're one of the most prominent voices we have urging a rational approach to this. But what do you see as the strategy, given if we look at drugs laws, things since your sacking under a Labour government, things have clearly got worse overall. There's obviously now the bright spot in Scotland. But how do you see the potential strategy to reform that?
There are one or two other bright spots. I mean, up before Scotland, the one or two, maybe three or four now, police commissioners and chief constables were effectively decriminalised personal possession of cannabis, arguing that it was a waste of police resources to prosecute people who were using small amounts or growing a small number of plants for personal use. So I think that should be rolled out. It is utter waste of police time to prosecute people for having small amounts of cannabis, and that should become a national standard. I think rescheduling drugs like MDMA and psilocybin from Schedule 1 to Schedule 2 will dramatically facilitate access for research, and more broadly we need some interventions like safe consumption rooms. Now that Scotland does have a safe consumption room, it's a van that drives into the middle of Glasgow each day and people can take drugs there and be resuscitated if they come to harm. We should have those in the UK as well, because that will reduce the deaths. And so what the government, we need to reframe our approach to drugs. Our approach should be about harm minimization, not about trying to reduce use, because reducing use, we've been doing that for 50 years and that's failed. So let's reduce the harms of drugs and accept that if people use drugs without harm, it's not really a criminal issue.
Professor David Nutt, it's been such an honour to have you. History will, of course, vindicate you in the end, but you remain a calm, lucid voice of reason in this, perhaps, of all the debates. I was going to say the mostly rational debate, but having looked at the state of politics over the last few years, that's quite a high bar to pass. But it is an irrational discussion, but you have injected so much reason and sense, and thanks so much for answering the questions. And
keep up the good work.
You as well. Keep fighting. Lots of love. Take
care. Hold the establishment to account, right?
Yeah. It's a team effort. Let's put it that way. Cheers.
Take care. Part of it. Thank you.
Fantastic stuff. Thanks so much there for David. Now, in terms of, just so we're clear, we're talking later, obviously, about Julian Assange and the extradition. And we're also talking about the LGB Alliance, a very eclectic Sunday for all of us. But I'm very, very chuffed to bring in our next guests. Kojo Karam, who is a lecturer in the Birkbeck Law Department. Am I getting that right in terms of how I describe that? Yes, presumably. I've got the gist. A fantastic voice on these issues. When I did a shout out on Twitter asking for voices, Kojo came up time and time again. And also my colleague at The Guardian, Matthew Busby, who's done some brilliant investigative journalism on this whole issue. And as I was saying before we came on, kind of looks at the moment like he's in, it looks like a psychedelic trip. I'm just saying, just looking at the video, that's just, it looks, it's interesting. That's all. Thanks so much for joining us, both of you. Koju, can I just start with you to kind of kick things off? And that's about, I suppose, the relationship of the left to this. And, you know, we have no shortage, obviously, of issues that we need to be talking about at the moment. Why is it so important the left takes a leading role in this debate and takes it seriously, I suppose?
I think the reason why we need to have the left try and take ownership of drug policy reform is because if the left doesn't, then the right will. The drug policy reform is something that we're seeing being increasingly experimented with all across the world. Uruguay, the first country to legalize cannabis in 2013. Since then, we've had Canada. We've had many of the states in the US. We've just had Luxembourg recently. This is something that is happening and being engaged with all across the world, whether we think about decriminalization, whether we think about diversion schemes, all of them concerned with this question of what do we do about drug policy. And it's not just the left that is contributing to this conversation. Obviously, with the commercial benefits that can be seen in cannabis legalization, that's getting a lot of interest with kind of free market right-wing institutions. The Adam Smith Institute has come out in support of cannabis legalization, CDAM, the Institute of Economic Affairs, and these leads to a situation where we find ourselves having the conversation for drug policy reform being driven more by the right in the UK than by the left. And that could lead to real problems if reform is actually implemented, because it's not just about changing the laws on drugs. I mean, the idea of changing the laws on drugs is essentially quite depoliticized. It's probably one of the, probably the only thing that you might get political agreement from everyone from, say, Ash Sarkar to Nigel Farage. Both of them have talked about drug policy reform, but it's about what does drug policy reform look like. And in the States, we've seen the multiple examples where the left have been involved and organized on the ground. We've seen drug policy reforms come along with commuting of sentences for prisoners so that people are able to have their criminal records erased. We've seen it come along with social equity programs, which have facilitated wealth transfer to over-policed and over-imprisoned Black population in the US. We've seen it come with licensing opportunities for communities that have been economically disadvantaged for generations. And then in other parts of the states, some of the early cannabis legalization states, particularly Colorado, where this wasn't, the left wasn't organized and didn't gain control of the conversation, we've essentially seen the creation of a very lucrative commercial cannabis industry, whilst at the same time, people are still serving out their sentences for being imprisoned. People who are released from prison are part of the few people who are barred from being able to enter the legal industry. So they're essentially punished twice, punished for a kind of unjust war on drugs, and then punished again by being excluded from this lucrative industry. And so if the left doesn't engage in that conversation, that could be recreated in the UK.
I mean, I spoke before, Matthew, about the irrationality of this whole debate, and you've just done a brilliant piece of investigative work for Vice. And this is about how the British government ignored secret recommendation from its own drug experts. So this is the Advisory Council on the Misuse of Drugs back in 2016 to decriminalise 5 years ago's drug-related death spiral. So you just want to explain what you found, basically, and what it kind of signifies.
Sure. Thanks, Owen. And yeah, apologies for the reflection on my phone.
No, I love it. It's atmospheric.
Yeah, so in 2016, after the Psychoactive Substances Act was passed, the chair of the ACMD at the time wrote to the government, to the Home Office, you know, highlighting that this new act, you know, didn't criminalise the use and possession of, you know, drugs such as spice and mamba. And that therefore, you know, there was a pretty big contradiction between that and the terms of the Misuse of Drugs Act, which does criminalise drug use and possession. So, you know, as David outlined, this is a 50-year-old law. And more enlightened thinking seemed to underpin the Psychoactive Substances Act in some respects. So, you know, the chair pointed that out, but I understand that, you know, the recommendation was dismissed, was given short shrift, and, you know, 5 years later, we're in the position we are now. It's also worth mentioning that, remarkably, these recommendations weren't made public at the time. Even the chair seemed to acknowledge that it was quite controversial. So, yeah, we have these recommendations happening behind closed doors, and that only came to light, you know, after a whistleblower came to me and told me about the report, which I made a Freedom of Information request to obtain. And, you know, amid lengthy delays, you know, that took about a year and a half, the Home Office has eventually garnered the support of the Information Commissioner to, yeah, not disclose the report.
I mean, on that, Koji, I mean, what's your kind of your response to that, but also what it says about the fact that actually in the US there has been more movement in many states than here in Britain? Because actually, as Professor David Knott actually points out, a lot of our own drug laws have been directly influenced by the overall so-called US war on drugs, which President Nixon most famously declared 50 years ago as part of his re-election efforts, as was also pointed out. So why have we ended up in that situation where, as Mather points out, the drug experts the government relies on have made it clear this is a disastrous approach they have at the moment? Why is it moved the dial so much more in the US than here?
Well, I think it's really helpful to try and kind of put our understanding of drugs in a historical context in order to understand why ideology continues to drive drug policy in opposition to the actual evidence that often the government's own experts are providing them. We need to remember that this idea of drugs, this idea of this collection of psychoactive substances that are so damaging to humans that the mere consumption of which can facilitate the destruction of society, is a very recent idea. You know, as Professor Knott was mentioning, it really emerges around the turn of the 20th century, and it's very much tied to the emergence of America as a international force. It's one of the first legal treaties that America initiates is the 1909 Shanghai Opium Commission. And prior to that, the trade in drugs was one of the main commodities that European empires traded around the world, the East India Corporation, the P.O. Shipping Company, the Opium Wars, you know, 19th century, Queen Victoria, Britain's own queen is the, you know, the world's Pablo Escobar, essentially. And where you have that change in the United States is very much tied to its own dynamics of kind of racial purification, paranoia about racial hierarchy. Recommend any of your listeners to just have a look at some of the headlines from around the turn of the 20th century on drugs. Look at the New York Times 1914 article, which is titled Negro Cocaine Fiends, the New Southern Menace, which talks about how cocaine is making black people in the South of America impervious to bullets. It's available for anyone to check out on LA Times article in 1905, Delirium and Death, which talks about how, you know, the Mexicans entering to California, bringing these cannabis substances that are destroying the local population and enslaving the minds of the good American people. This is really the kind of dynamic that the war on drugs emerges through. And it has a real stranglehold over not just American policy, but also international policy through the UN and through the INCB and the other institutions that David Nutt mentioned for most of the 20th century. But what we've seen over the last real 10 years in the United States of America is organization around racial justice and against mass incarceration on the ground, leading to essentially popular referendums in a lot of the states, Colorado, California, Alaska, Massachusetts, the ability for people on the ground to be able to put the question of drug legalization on a referendum ballot has led to states changing the laws in the United States of America, even though the federal government still hasn't yet taken that step. And so we started to see Not just cannabis legalization, but as Professor Nutt mentioned, the decriminalization of all drugs in Oregon in the last 2020 electoral cycle, leading to a different direction that the US is taking. Whilst in the UK, because we have a much more centralized Westminster-based authority, we don't have that same mechanism of kind of grassroots popular democracy to be able to change the laws in those local levels. And so if we have a Home Secretary like we do at the moment in Priti Patel, who constantly talks about how she wants to make example out of middle-class cocaine users, despite most of her colleagues confessed users, then you're not going to get the kind of change in the UK that we've seen in the US and in other parts of the world.
I mean, on that, even though obviously the position is quite bleak, Matthew, I'm quite interested in a piece you wrote actually for the Bristol Cable. We've had their journalists on before, actually. So the Home Office is very clear. It says it has no plans to decriminalise drugs. But, and these are small chinks of light, but that it's worth at least interrogating it. So there's a pilot project in Bristol, £5 million pilot project, to get more people into treatment, prevent reoffending, being backed by the Home Office. So you just want to explain a little bit about that and maybe what it represents.
Sure. And as David outlined, with the police force led decriminalization schemes for first offenders, this just dovetails with that, and it's kind of the Home Office doing catch-up work. The second word of the acronym ADDA, Project ADDA, is diversion. And diverting people away from the criminal justice system is in effect decriminalization. But obviously, as the Vice story showed, there hasn't been any repeal of the subsection of the Misuse of Drugs Act that prohibits drug use and possession. So yeah, what we have now is, I think, about a dozen areas of the country, including Bristol, that have received some central funding to improve treatment programs, to reduce reoffending. And as part of this raft of measures, there is the acknowledgement from the government of these police decriminalization schemes. And they're kind of crafting this policy to complement that. And as you say, people will look at it as a chink of light, and yeah, it does highlight a pretty stark, contradiction between the oft trumpeted line that we have no plans to decriminalise drugs, when in effect it's palpably untrue.
In terms of drug prohibition, it's very important we call it that as well, because in the popular imagination, prohibition is acknowledged in terms of alcohol in the United States as a catastrophic failure because of the consequences it had in terms of the criminal industry it boosted, in terms of people dying because they took impure versions of alcohol. I'll just quickly as well, because Kojo's in a public place, so we need to be careful here, because he don't want to suddenly get him kicked out of the pub he's using, just quickly while he talks to them. I'll just check with KJ, make sure that's okay. But in terms of drug prohibition and racism, I mean, we've touched on this already, but do you just want to explain a bit more? And by the way, KJ, if you need to leg it shortly, let me know as well, because KJ's on his travels. He's out to Warrington, my part of the world, but he probably has to leg it soon, so just let me know. But go for it, KJ, sorry. Drug prohibition and racism.
Well, I think that, in addition to some of the stuff that I just mentioned before, that's the kind of historical legacy of the relationship between race and drug prohibition. We can look at how that bleeds into the contemporary makeup of mass incarceration, both in the US, where it has been the real driver of putting black bodies into ever-expanding prison systems. I really started thinking about drug policy wherein I worked in Louisiana, and Louisiana is a state where for 2.5 pounds of marijuana you can receive up to 10 years in prison. In the United States of America, you have 46% of all federal prisoners in 2019, according to the latest justice statistics, being in prison for drug offences. And whilst that's an extreme version, the UK is not too far behind. Ministry of Justice statistics, 27% of all prisoners currently being held on remand are being held on remand for drug offences. This is the largest percentage of all offences. And so it's the real driver of mass incarceration and the expansion of the prison system in not just the US and the UK, but in a lot of other places around the world, Brazil, Colombia, South Africa. And that's before we start thinking about the other outside of prison criminalization that happens with drug prohibition. We think about stop and search, 9 times more likely for Black people to be stopped and searched for drugs. We can think about the way that a drug conviction can impact everything from your ability to access jobs, to your ability to being able to have custody of your own children. These are all impacted by drug convictions. And so there's an absolute architecture of social isolation that can result from drug prohibition, and that has impacted disproportionately on people of color in a number of different contexts all around the globe. And so this is part of the reason why the left needs to intervene in the conversation around drug policy, because that part of drug policy reform is not going to be as privileged by the more commercial, more capitalist focused drug policy reform that is being driven from the right, with the cannabis industry being estimated as turning over £22 billion in retail sales in 2022 across the world. This is something that is going to get the interest of any right-wing free marketer worth their salt. But the way that that would be implemented and the way that would be carried out, I think, is very different than if the left is driving it with questions of racial justice and economic justice at the forefront. The danger otherwise is to have a situation where you have a highly commercialized, highly lucrative legal cannabis industry, which is making a lot of money for people in the City of London or Wall Street, but at the same time you actually have increased policing and increased incarceration of a black market that continues to reproduce those racialized dynamics.
Just lastly, for both of you, drug decriminalisation and legalisation obviously are not the same thing. If you sum up, because I think Koji's got to go as well, but just to wrap up the conversation, what's the difference? Where do you think those of us who want a change should be focusing our energies? So do you want to start with that, Matthew, in terms of decriminalisation, legalisation, and where we should stand and the distinction?
Well, yeah. In very simple terms, decriminalization is not directing people or putting people into the criminal justice system for using and possessing drugs. So, in the case of half a dozen or so police force areas in the UK, for instance, first time offenders go through a kind of driver's awareness style drug education course. But obviously, the schemes receive criticism that they don't go far enough. Obviously, second, third, and fourth time people caught with drugs, still face the possibility of criminal sanctions. And then, if we're regulating drugs and legalizing them, many models have been put forward. Many of the most serious under consideration come from Transform Drug Policy Foundation. And broadly speaking, you would see drugs regulated in, a similar way that, many other addictive and harmful drugs are regulated through pharmacies. And, depending on, the type of addiction you might have, you might be able to have a drug prescribed to you, and otherwise you might be able to buy it under certain parameters.
Kojo, do you want to just wrap up on that as well, just on decriminalization, legalization, where we should stand?
Yeah, I think that one thing that we want to consider is decriminalization, I think, is obviously a necessary first step. Not treating people who are using substances with the criminal law, I think, is an immediate improvement on the status quo that we have at the moment. But there are questions around what does that do with the global supply chain of drugs, thinking about how a lot of drugs are produced in kind of global south countries. You mentioned the introduction, the impact of the war on drugs has had on places like Mexico and Colombia, Afghanistan. All of these questions are some things that are not immediately addressed by the decriminalization of drugs within one jurisdiction. So I think, you know, these are there's many different varieties of drug policy reform, and that there is a lot of different alternatives on the table, not just in terms of particular models, but also which models might work for particular drugs. You know, we might think of safe consumption rooms for opiates. We might think of legalization for cannabis. We might think of decriminalization for cocaine. So it could be a lot of different stuff for different substances. But the main thing is to recognize that this is a an issue that isn't just a kind of more decadent kind of personal liberty issue, which is often the way the drug policy is described as, but this is something that touches on racial justice, economic justice, and more importantly, on how the left wants to recreate the world for the future, even thinking about environmental justice with the way in which the war on drugs has devastated large amounts of agricultural territory in the world, with aerial fumigation policies, crop eradication policies, devastating places in the Cali region of Colombia or rural Afghanistan. These are all touching upon this question of drug policy reform, and the left should be front and center in this conversation.
Both of you, thank you so, so much. That was just brilliant, comprehensive stuff, touched on so much. And do follow both of them on social media. Kojokram, Kojokram. And you can also follow Matha on, I'm just looking up now, I was just literally having to look on my phone. Here we go. Oh, it's just his name. It's Matha, M-A-T-T-H-A, and then B-U-S-B-Y. So do follow both of them. They're both fantastic. And do huge amounts of brilliant work in this field. So thank you so much to both of you, and have a great Sunday.
Thanks, Owen. All the best.
Take care.
Cheers. Cheers.
Nice. Take care. So we are now going to talk about Julian Assange, who faces extradition. Now, those extradition proceedings are obviously in motion, but at the same time, there is a so-called Belmarsh Tribunal, which is putting the United States instead on trial for the crimes committed in another so-called war, the War on Terror. Now, we're joined by the brilliant philosopher Sreco Horvat. So, thank you, Horvat. So, thank you so much for joining us, Sreco. Really, really appreciate it. How are you doing?
Hi, Owen. I'm really glad to be here with you. Even so if the topic is a bit dire, but I think it's very important to talk about it just before the extradition hearing on Wednesday and Thursday.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, anything we talk about right now is pretty bleak because that's the world we're stuck with, unfortunately, for now. Do you just want to explain to people exactly where things stand? So a lot of people obviously might have been following on and off this saga, but just a kind of basic summary, what is the plight Julian Assange currently faces? You know, what's the case? And where do things stand with the extradition proceedings?
Well, I mean, what is important to say is that this is not new. I mean, this case has been dragging on for almost more than 10 years. Julian Assange has been entrapped at the Ecuadorian embassy in London for more than 7 years. You have all seen the images, how the police was dragging him out of the embassy. And what basically happened, I think, is really a scandal, which is an embarrassment for the United Kingdom, I would say. It's an embarrassment for Ecuador, of course, who gave him the political asylum at the very beginning. But it's also an embarrassment for the UK, where you actually have CIA, a secret service from the United States, intervening into your sovereignty, intervening into your soil, basically kidnapping a journalist and putting him in a prison, Belmarsh prison, which is in London. He's there already for more than 2.5 years. What is happening now is that the United States is going to appeal, which is happening on Wednesday and Thursday, and they basically want a publisher, a journalist, for 175 years in prison, in a high-security prison in the United States. I think this is a matter which concerns all of us. I'm not a journalist. I'm also not a whistleblower. But they became active in this case because they saw that this is something which will have consequences well, not on the future, it already has consequences on free speech, on democracy, on what we can actually publish, what we can say. And it's a scandal that a man who didn't commit any crime, but he actually revealed the war crimes in Afghanistan, in Iraq, surveillance programs by the CIA, that this courageous publisher is put on trial while the United States, Washington, United Kingdom, Ecuador, Sweden are not put on trial for their crimes. And this is why we founded the Belmarsh Tribunal, which actually happened 2 days ago in Westminster at Church House, influenced by the famous Arthur Russell Tribunal.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
So let's talk a bit about the Belmarsh Tribunal. So what is the kind of, you know, what were the kind of focus? What were the kind of issues that it raised in terms of the crimes committed in the 20 years since the so-called War on Terror was announced, almost exactly 20 years ago?
Yeah, for us at the Progressive International, who organized this event, it was very important to gather physically because I guess, okay, we are now over the screens again and everyone is quite fed up with the digitalization of all social relations. And for us, it was important to gather physically at a historical place where the House of, where the Parliament of the United Kingdom was having its meetings during World War II, and to gather people who were in one or the other way involved in the case or who are experts, lawyers, politicians. We had, for instance, Tariq Ali, who was an original member of the Bertrand Russell Tribunal, who traveled to Vietnam to investigate the crimes of the United States in Vietnam. We had Daniel Ellsberg, who in 1971, I know that previously in the context of the war on drugs, you were speaking about Nixon. So we had this historic figure, historic whistleblower, Daniel Ellsberg with us as well. Edward Snowden, Jeremy Corbyn, many people gathered 2 days ago, and in the next days, we are going to publish the verdicts and the findings of the Belmarsh Tribunal. But I can tell you already now that the findings paint a much dire picture that I think the broader audience could imagine. And this is crimes which were committed by the United States, but also by the United Kingdom and their allies. These are war crimes, killings of civilians and journalists, which was revealed by WikiLeaks in the Collateral Murder Widow or in the Afghan and Iraq warlocks, rendition, torture, spying of CIA. We had people at the tribunal who witnessed that when they were visiting the Ecuadorian embassy, well, you know where it is, just opposite to Harrods in the midst of British civilization. They were spying on everyone who came in, including the lawyers. I mean, I found myself on the CIA list as well. And I didn't work for WikiLeaks. I didn't publish any documents or whatever, just because I went into the Ecuadorian embassy. So you can see that this case on so many levels is an embarrassment for United Kingdom, especially recently, 1 week ago, it was revealed that the CIA had a plan to either kidnap or kill Julian Assange. You know, imagine if that happened in, and something similar happened in Istanbul, and you've seen how many people jumped from their chairs and said, this cannot happen in a country. What kind of dictatorship, authoritarian system it is in Turkey if you can just slaughter a journalist? Or remember Navalny and how many liberals came out to support Navalny. Also, we couldn't really say that his politics is something which me or you would support, you know, his racism or right-wing politics. But nevertheless, everyone supported him. So in the case of Julian Assange, what happened is, of course, a character assassination, which was also supported by those who were actually working with him, who were very happy to work with him at the very beginning. The New York Times, The Guardian, who then turned against him and actually were used as weapons of mass deception. I mean, the best example is when Paul Manafort supposedly visited the Ecuadorian embassy, an article which was published in The Guardian, and something which never happened. So what you can see here is that for 10 years, the character assassination started, starting with Sweden and then to the DNC leaks and so on. A character assassination was being fulfilled, which was then actually with Mike Pompeo leading to plans to really assassinate him. And what is happening now is that he is slowly being assassinated in London at Belmarsh prison for more than 2.5 years. So I think that's something what concerns all of us. It shows the cynicism, the double measures of the liberal elites who will support Navalny or someone else but won't support Julian. But what we can see, and I think the Belmarsh tribunal is contributing to it, the support has never been so big. All major human rights, press freedom organizations stood for Julian. At the Belmarsh tribunal, we also had so many people who were actually revealing the crimes of those who were revealed by Julian Assange. And I think that's very important. Although our tribunal doesn't have any kind of legal, you know, authority, but, well, that's in the tradition of the Rastas Arthur Tribunal.
On the cycle war on terror itself, one of the many bleak aspects of it is that everything that those of us who opposed it said, actually, things actually turned out even worse, probably, than many of the dire predictions at the very beginning. If we look at the calamities that enveloped Afghanistan, the absolute horror of Iraq, but also, of course, we can see more broadly, we can see the drone war, for example. We can see, Libya technically wasn't, I suppose, under the aegis of the war on terror, but it was another catastrophic Western war, which caused calamitous, again, consequences in Libya. So all these interventions, to use that slightly clinical term, have been a calamitous failure on their own terms and in terms of human consequences. And the so-called, and it's worth pointing out, the very courageous role of Chelsea Manning, but the exposure, you know, that WikiLeaks of the crimes committed by the West had a big impact. But I suppose, are you optimistic or pessimistic in terms of how much, you know, it's one thing that we can say in the worst possible way, vindication of our arguments, not that there's any satisfaction given the consequences. But after, in the aftermath of the West's, of the US withdrawal from Afghanistan, how do you feel in terms of, you know, preventing these sorts of horrors happening? Have those movements which WikiLeaks were part of, have they succeeded in some way, or do you feel pretty depressed about future prospects?
Yeah, I mean, I'm rarely being optimistic, not because I'm pessimistic, but I quite like this phrase by Terry Eagleton, hope without optimism. I think we definitely need to hope that things will get better, but we also have to prepare that they will get much worse. I mean, I'm glad that you mentioned the drone warfare, because there is currently in solitary confinement in a high security prison in the United States a very courageous whistleblower called Daniel Hale. And at the Belmarsh Tribunal, we had the director of forensic architecture, Eyal Weitzman, talking about the drone warfare in Palestine and other places. And this is a big topic. And it's also very sad that such a person as Julian Assange is imprisoned, that he's silenced, because I will just remind you of the book, which was published in 2014, I think, but it was written, or the event on which the book was formed happened exactly 10 years ago, when the Arab Spring was happening, you know, when there was hope that in these parts of the world, social movements could take over and so on. 10 years later, of course, there is not much hope anymore. And the name of the book is When Google Met WikiLeaks. And I think it's very important to speak about it today, precisely in the relation to drone warfare and how, in the meantime, the technological apparatus, to put it like that, the industrial military complex accelerated, developed even further. I mean, this is what WikiLeaks started to kind of shed light on, Edward Snowden as well. But nowadays, and then CIA, of course, I think the biggest embarrassment for the CIA and why Mike Pompeo really wanted to kill Julian Assange, which is now revealed. The biggest embarrassment for the CIA was the so-called Vault 7 revelations by WikiLeaks, which revealed this massive surveillance program by the CIA. So coming back to that book from 2011, I mean, there is not much reason to hope, because actually what Julian Assange claimed in that book, and I've also had many conversations when I was visiting the Ecuadorian embassy with him, is that Silicon Valley is accelerating and taking over our basic infrastructure. I mean, at that time, it was Google, which was in close relations with Washington. Of course, the connection between Google and Hillary Clinton or their role in Syria, that's well known. You can find it in WikiLeaks. But nowadays, just look at the United Kingdom. I mean, I just came back from the United Kingdom, but your country, mate, I'm sorry to say so, is in a much, much worse state than ever. Just look at the penetration of Palantir, you know, the company by Peter Thiel, into the NHS. Just look how the pandemic is serving the cashless society and how everyone is already being surveilled. I'm not here a conspiracy theorist, but this is a fact. You know, in London, I couldn't pay anything in cash anymore. And who will take over? Who has the infrastructure? Look at our program now. And I'm not criticizing you, you know. The Belmarsh Tribunal was live streamed on YouTube. You know, how does this look from the perspective of Mark Zuckerberg or Jeff Bezos when us, the progressives, the subversives, are using their technology in order to criticize them, but we are still in their bubble? You know, we are using the presuppositions which they have laid down, you know, for us. And Julian Assange was constantly speaking about it. You know, I remember, for instance, I think that was 5-6 years ago at the Ecuadorian embassy, we had a very long conversation, which lasted very long. That was before the CIA started to spy on the embassy, before Ecuador cut down the internet. So the situation was still kind of, we could have intellectual conversations. He was following the news and so on. And basically his main point was that the main source of future profit for Silicon Valley, he said that five or six years ago, is transport. And look today, when you have, on the one hand, the images of Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk, you know, going into the privatization of space, of course, heavily state funded, like always, like the invention of the internet. And then you have venture capitalists taking over. Or look at Uber, or look at Amazon. It is all about transport. And Silicon Valley is now going there. So what I really miss is Julian's voice on technology. I think this is really crucial to speak about the war on terror in terms of technology, because also what Edward Snowden revealed is this massive surveillance program. But nowadays, with the pandemic, I think the situation is much, much worse. And in that sense, I don't have much optimism, just hope without optimism.
A slightly bleak point to end, unfortunately, but nonetheless, it's okay. It is what it is. But nonetheless, Fako, it's such an honor to have had you and so eloquently explained the current situation.
It's eloquently in my Balkan English, but I hope your viewers won't mind. Yeah,
I think it's your English was more than clear, but we really, really appreciate it. And do check out Swako's brilliant work, brilliant philosopher. And thank you so much. And enjoy the rest of your Sunday. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, you too. Everyone should enjoy Sunday a bit.
I'm going to go for a nice little stroll in the sun. It's cold, okay. But I will be out. But look, take care, okay. See you in a bit.
Bye. Thanks.
Take care. Katie, I've just thrown you right in there. Okay. Sorry, there was absolutely no build-up of any description. We are where we are. Wait a minute. Before I continue, I just have to show everyone the full beautiful flag. Look at that. Loving it, Katie. So just to explain, so Katie is one of my highlights on Twitter. Twitter is obviously just a nightmare. A website of horror. But
It's the worst website on the internet.
The absolute worst
mainstream website. There are worse websites.
Yeah, I mean, good point. I mean, some pretty grim ones. But it's still, it's horrific. But Katie's one of the chinks of light. Always, every time I see a Katie tweet, great content for free. Don't have to pay for it. And Katie's a brilliant. Do check out Katie's YouTube channel. What's it called? How would people find it, actually?
If you just search for my name, so it's just here, Katie Montgomery. So it's Katie and Montgomery spelled the opposite way around to what you'd expect. Katie with a Y and Montgomery with an IE.
Yeah, that is really confusing. sort it out. So, Katie, the reason we are blessed with your brilliant presence is because, I mean, part of me thinks, should we talk about them and give them any attention? But I suppose it's just a hook, isn't it? So the so-called LGB Alliance, a ludicrous organization set up entirely to fight trans rights. Some people try and gaslight us into pretending they were set up to champion the interest of same-sex attractive people who aren't being catered for by anybody else. They're not. They're the only interest they have is issues of fighting trans rights.
Yeah.
In the transphobic hellscape, that is the United Kingdom. Hooray. So they had their conference last week, which was loads of fun, and they had a disco, which was I was going to put up a clip, but my producer's hungover, so it's just me doing this today. But it's just this. Just look up the LGB Alliance disco if any of you want to. Do go for a long walk afterwards. It's traumatic.
I saw a good comment which said, thanks to LGB Alliance for combating the harmful homophobic stereotype that all gay people are stylish and good at dancing.
Fair. I already single-handedly had achieved that. So the LGB Alliance did not need to set themselves up. I already had that catered for without transphobia. So
well done.
If you want bad dancing and a lack of style without transphobia, hey, Katie, just explain, who are the LGB Alliance and what was their conference all about?
Right. So, yeah, as you mentioned, they're a group who are trying to pose themselves as pro-gay rights, but like without trans people. Because obviously, when we talk about gay rights, people often say LGBT. And that's like a common acronym you hear all the time. And they're trying to say LGB without the T. And the way they pose themselves is, oh, we just care about gay rights. We just don't care about trans people. That's it. We're not transphobic. We're just pro-gay. And I mean, that is an issue on its own, because all homophobia and transphobia comes from similar places. It comes from often the same people. And when we look at transphobic arguments today and how trans people are treated in the news, it's identical to homophobic arguments of the past and how gay people are treated, like in the news and in the media. And it's all just recycled. So to think that you can just separate those two things is naive at best. But on top of that, there's two main issues with that. And I think that often the media tries to present it as like, oh, trans people are just jealous that there's this gay rights organization and they're grumpy because they're not included. That isn't the issue. Like, as I just mentioned, that could be an issue. But the issue here is that they are actively, directly campaigning against trans rights, and not just in a mild way. So, for example, they are a signatory on this thing called the WHRC Declaration, which calls for the, like, almost total gutting of all trans rights internationally. So this calls for a complete and total ban of all trans women and girls from the women's spaces they use today. So that'll be including banning people from, like me, from going to the toilet at work, changing rooms, all this kind of stuff. It calls for a total ban of trans healthcare. So this is the internationally recommended expert healthcare for under 18s. And it calls for loads of extra wacky things, like a ban of research into helping trans women with pregnancy as a possibility in the future, which is, you know, at the moment, just some kind of sci-fi dream. And that they've called for a ban of legal protections against misogyny and transphobia for trans people, and make it legal so people could misgender and say your old name and stuff, like, with impunity. So make it legal so that someone at work could just harass me and then we couldn't do anything about it. So, you know, this is already a huge issue. This is a very extreme position to take. But they're also involved in campaigning against a conversion therapy ban, which is one of the things that the LGBT community in the UK is kind of focusing on at the moment. The government has said they're going to do a conversion therapy ban, and they're dragging their feet, because of course they are, because they're rubbish. And the LGB Alliance is involved in pushing against that. And like, for anyone who doesn't know, conversion therapy is evil. I mean, it's effectively torture, and it's where you try and force a LGBT person to no longer be LGBT. And you'd think, why are these people claiming to speak for gay rights opposing a conversion therapy ban? And the reason is because they want conversion therapy to be legal for trans people. So they don't like any ban. You couldn't bring in a ban that just banned it just for trans people, just for gay people, because it's all, again, it's the same thing. It's all intermingled. It's come from the same people. It's the same ideas. So they're worried if conversion therapy got banned for gay people, then it would affect trans people as well. So, it, like, you know, they are directly campaigning against our rights. And I think the media always just misses this. Like, it just tries to pose it as if it's some brave gay rights group going on their own, and that's just nonsense. And also, as you kind of mentioned, like, I don't know how you feel as like a, you know, gay man. Have LGB Alliance done anything for you? I mean, they've done literally nothing. There's no positive action that they've done.
Well, they've slightly riled me, I suppose.
Well, everyone needs a good riling, I guess.
Yeah, I mean...
railing? No, anyway.
on a Sunday.
So, on a Sunday,
the day of rest. But not for me.
But yeah, so they just had their conference, and the conference was, you know, the who's who of anti-trans people in the UK at the moment. A lot of straight people. And I think that's worth noting. One of their founders was a straight woman who actually raised thousands of pounds, maybe £100,000. I can't remember the exact figure, to try and get some judicial review to get it so you can ban trans women from toilets and things, which failed, luckily. But yeah, there's quite a few straight people involved in this. And as we see, usually their supporters are straight cis men who are really angry suddenly for the first time in their lives about gay people, if they can use them as an excuse to attack trans people. But yeah, their conference had several speakers, including some, they had a stand from this group, WHRC, who this extremist organization who I was just mentioning, who have written this declaration. One event that I was actually discussing yesterday in a podcast, if anyone's interested, was a trans lady called Jen Ives kind of went undercover there and had, you know, discussions with people. She is bisexual, so technically she should be welcome there, but received a load of transphobic abuse when she outed herself, and so that was a kind of a disaster. I feel like the whole point in their conference, you know, they spent so much money on it. They've got all this flashy artwork and like all this kind of stuff and all these speakers, and they picked a very official venue. But I don't feel like it's to win over LGBT people, win over, you know, get the general gay public, because I think everyone knows, you know, most gay people who have heard of them know that they're just not doing anything pro gay rights. The idea is to just look official for politicians, because like the current Conservative government doesn't seem to like LGBT people, because it's done absolutely nothing for us so far, and I feel that it's part of this attack on Stonewall and other like larger LGBT rights charities that they want to replace them with some like absolute nothing group that doesn't do anything, that has said in the past, well, if you oppose gay marriage, that's fine, you know, it doesn't matter. Because then there won't be a credible opposition if the government does want to take our rights away.
It's interesting you point out about the, in terms of the role of often straight people who are signal boosting this organization, in terms of the prominence it gets, it is overwhelmingly from people who are straight and often opposed to LGBTQ rights. Lots of straight people with records of saying terrible things about bisexual people.
Well, including one of their speakers was a Conservative politician, Jackie Doyle Price, who voted against gay marriage. There's another politician, Baroness Nicholson, who is still openly opposed to gay marriage, who is one of their biggest supporters, and they continuously thank. Like, you know, these people are just unambiguously anti-gay and are some of their biggest supporters. And I think that alone should raise red flags for most gay people.
And some of those politicians as well who've been prominent, I don't just oppose, for example, gay rights, but some of the politicians oppose trans rights, for example, oppose abortion rights, for example.
Yeah, I mean,
feminism.
It's a classic combination. Usually, if you're one, you're all three.
It's interesting, though, in terms of, because I said a lot of straight people, but you get this, I'm just bringing up this article, which was written by James Gregg. He's a brilliant journalist. It was for Gawker. Talking about gay men who are so-called gender critical, which is basically intellectual veneer for transphobia. I just want to read it out because it's just really funny. There's a certain kind of gay man who embodies the gender critical vibe. He's white, middle class, and exactly 45 years old. And even though he works as a corporate lawyer, thinks teenagers with dyed blue hair are an oppressor class. His Twitter bio reads something like, snarky prick taking aim at the tyranny of twaddle, or why drink the Kool-Aid when you can have a lovely G&T? His pronouns are sod, slash off or jog on. He's not especially interested in gay culture and instead prefers the standard fare of middle-brow English liberals, George Orwell and the Great British Bake Off, Solzhenitsyn and Strictly Come Dancing, comedy panel shows called I'm Afraid I Haven't the Foggiest, and popular history books titled Bothersome Broads, A Feminist History Told Through 12 Grating Girls. Anyway, the whole thing, it's just funny. Because
that's very true.
For those who've ever come across gender-critical men on Twitter, the most tedious people ever created, their bigotry aside, they will know what that is. In terms of, though, as a trans person, I mean, obviously, we're laughing at certain aspects here, but obviously, this is not funny for trans people. And this is, you know, we talk about a lot on the show. We talked about Stonewall last week. We've got, obviously, the main LGBTQ civil rights organisation under concerted attack when transphobic hate crimes have quadrupled in the last few years and homophobic hate crimes have trebled.
And those things are related.
Let's talk about those. I'll ask you about those two things. So firstly, just in terms of what, you know, every day you've got this something new. There's like a Times article or there's this conference. Yeah, or
every day.
So what impact, I mean, just what impact does that have, you know, on trans people? But I am also interested, and I need to be careful as a cis gay man that I don't go, well, actually the real issue here is it's ricocheting into homophobia. The transphobia is on itself, obviously, a very, very big problem. But it is worth observing. It is ricocheting. And Chris Bryant, of all people, a very, a Blairite Labour MP, tweeted yesterday about how it's becoming fashionable again for people to openly hate LGBT people. That's because it's like a gateway drug, transphobia, and then you get the whole shebang.
It is.
So that first thing about being trans during this just horror show, and then that broader point about how it broadens out.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, I think that there can't be a trans person in the UK, you know, who hasn't been affected by this in some way. It is truly relentless. And maybe I'm more involved in it than a lot of people. You know, I spend a lot of time on the internet and I'm aware of what's going on. But I get people messaging me all the time, you know, scared because of the, you know, the feeling of, where is this country going? Are we going to start losing rights? We've had several major court cases in the last couple of years, you know, put forward by gender critical people, where if it had gone badly for us, we would have actually lost real rights that we have and need every single day. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, there's the media, which is constantly scaremongering about us, saying that we're coming for children, or that we're a danger to women, or just every kind of made up thing, often completely fabricated. And with just no pushback, the whole media spectrum from, you know, the Times to the Guardian is publishing wall-to-wall transphobia. And it's terrifying and it's really emotionally draining. I've particularly over lockdown, I mean, the one thing that gives me life is I can go on the internet and I can see all this garbage written about trans people and get all this transphobic abuse from people, which I get literally all the time, hourly. Constant transphobic abuse on the internet. But then I can go out into the real world and see my friends and go to the pub and go to work and just live a normal life. But in lockdown, obviously that wasn't an option. And it's just so oppressive. You can't go on the internet anywhere without it just coming up in comment sections, you know, on YouTube, some celebrity you like has to have some transphobic opinion and suddenly everyone has to discuss them. You know, your favorite author comes out as transphobic. We just had another one this week. It's so tiring and it's so stressful and it just feels like they're shooting fish in a barrel, really. Like, we don't have any trans politicians, we don't have any trans friendly media outlets, major ones. We don't have, you know, it just doesn't feel like we have anything. It's not a two sides. It's not a debate. They keep saying they want a debate, but they're just talking on their own, which is, it's very stressful, and it's definitely got to everyone. Everyone I've talked to, I haven't talked to a single trans person, and I've talked to hundreds of UK trans people. I haven't talked to a single one that has said, I felt fine over this, like the last 5 years. But yeah, and then in terms of how it relates to homophobia, I do think that obviously being a trans person, you notice the transphobia going on. Of course, any when you're a member of any group, you're going to notice the prejudice against your group more. And so it's going to seem like a big deal to you and other people might miss it. If you're a cis person, you might miss it, particularly if you're cis and straight and you're not really plugged into the LGBT community. but I do think it's getting to the point where people are starting to notice. I don't think you could have missed it now. And I think that gay people are, you know, the strongest allies of trans rights have been cis gay people, because they can just see it's all the same stuff again. But some have had the luxury of just being able to ignore it, or maybe they're just not really quite sure about trans people, and it now turning into a general attack on all LGBT rights is starting to cause them to be a bit uncomfortable and to wake up and see what's going on. And I think that's a good thing. So I do think it's important to highlight that this does affect gay people. You are not going to be able to just sit this out if you're a cis gay person, even if you're one of the good ones who just fits in with, you know, society and you don't have blue hair or whatever the things that they all like to whine about. But the reason this happens is because these little thought patterns where you dehumanize some group because they don't quite fit into patriarchal society how you want, and these little excuses like, oh, I don't hate trans people, I just hate the crazy activists, and then you call every single trans person an activist. That is the technique that they used on gay people. I don't hate gay people, I just hate the activists, or I don't hate the people, I just hate the sin, I just think that it's an ideology, I don't like trans ideology. And when you learn these little tricks in your mind to justify your transphobia, it's so easy to just expand those to gay people. Once you've learned the phrase, I don't hate trans people, I just hate trans ideology, and then you're standing shoulder to shoulder with homophobes at the LGB Alliance conference because they want all the allies they can get. And then you hear them say, instead of them saying, I don't hate trans people, I hate trans ideology, they say, I don't hate LGBT people, I hate LGBT ideology. And you're like, oh yeah, that makes sense. It's just the same argument. And then you're won over to that. And I see people being radicalized. I've watched people in real time become, go from just have concerns to I'm gender critical, I don't hate trans people, to I don't hate LGBT people. And suddenly they're supporting all these homophobic politicians and voting for Donald Trump because he's not trying to raise women and gay people. I think it should be scary for anyone. This isn't just something that trans people are going to deal with.
Just finally, amongst this horror show, what do you think, how can people be allies, whether they be cis gay people or straight people? What would you as a trans person, what would you ask people in terms of how they can be better allies?
Right. I think on the smallest scale, if you know a trans person, then just let them know that you're there for them. I think that you could maybe think like, oh, I don't want to kind of be imposing, or that I'm friendly with them, they're my work colleague, that's fine. But lots of us do feel quite isolated, and it's quite difficult to bring up. Sometimes when I'm talking to my friends, I'm like, how's it going? And I just feel like, do I tell them about how the latest attack on my human rights and tomorrow is a court case and I might have no rights tomorrow? Like, it's such a big deal. And when people do reach out and they say, it's okay, I support you, I'm here for you, this kind of stuff, that makes a difference. Mm-hmm. Take some time to just learn about the basics of what's going on. Follow some trans people on Twitter. It doesn't have to be me, or on YouTube.
It should be Katie, though. Yeah. It should be Katie.
It can be me along with others, and just get a range of perspectives. And I think one thing as well that's quite important is, at the moment, if you stick your head up above the parapet and say, I support trans rights, or I think J.K. Rowling was transphobic or something, especially if you do it on social media, you're likely to get a huge, horrible pylon. And that's because, you know, especially if you're a bigger figure or you work for a big organization or something, because they want to shut this down hard and fast. Mm-hmm. And some people do back down because it's horrible. Like, experiencing this is horrible. And I think if enough people start doing it, then they won't be able to target everyone, and the bile will be spread out more. But also it just shows that it's not acceptable. I think a lot of what drives transphobia is that people think that it's okay. They think it's normal. They think they won't be judged for it. And for a lot of people, for their whole life, they haven't been. This is only really the first time in recent history where being transphobic will get you any pushback at all. And they don't like that. And they want to look around the room. And if they say something transphobic and someone calls them out, they want to look around and see everyone doing nothing in response, and then they'll just imagine, oh, everyone agrees with me. And if everyone stands up and's like, no, that's disgusting, like, don't do that, then it kind of shames them into addressing their own irrational prejudices, I think.
Katie, you are a superstar. As I said, one of the highlights of an otherwise horrific website, but really always just on point, you know, given the amount of just, as you say, just awful, awful transphobic abuse that you're subjected to. Your Twitter feed, and there's no right way of responding to it, but you've got a very funny Twitter feed. It's funny. That's why. It's just a funny, joyous Twitter feed, often just in the best possible way, satirizing some of these horrific bigots that you have to deal with.
Yeah, I get some of the most extreme stuff, and in a way, the only way you can deal with that is to show people and be like, look how ridiculous this is. Right. Look, these arguments are disgusting or violent or just plainly irrational. And if you don't look with your friends and laugh, then you will just cry. So that's my strategy.
Well, you do it so wonderfully, honestly. It's been such a pleasure to have you. Do follow Katie on Twitter, which is Katie's name, Katie, K-A-T-Y, then Montgomery, but with an I-E, not a Y at the end.
Yeah.
Just to confuse everyone. Just keep everyone on their toes, Katie.
Yeah, that people write my name wrong every single time and then I have to correct them.
And do check out her YouTube channel as well, which you can find again. It's just a name, her confusingly spelt name. But it's been a real pleasure, and solidarity and love as ever. And it is important, you know, one thing I suppose I would say, given the LGBT, I mean, I think it's interesting for a while because the most prominent anti-trans rights organization was A Woman's Place to begin with. And they used that whole, I mean, it is a cult. They behave like a cult, so let's just call them a cult. They use that to go, well, this is basically an intra-feminist argument. And, you know, therefore, you know, what right do gay men, for example, have to intervene? And then they set up the LGB Alliance, which is the main most prominent organization now, which people use now to describe people like myself as homophobes. Now I'm a homophobe because I support trans rights, but I mean, all I'm saying is, you know, they're doing that to try and divide LGBTQ people. And I don't think we should pretend it'd be easy to just glamorize LGBT communities as one big happy family where we're all standing together. We've got big problems of racism, big problems of things like disableism. I mean, misogyny, lesbophobia. There are huge, genuine problems of prejudice and bigotry and transphobia for that matter.
And but just a wide range of thought too. I mean,
exactly.
Being LGBT is just a thing that you're like born. So exactly. It just affects everyone just randomly across society.
But it is important though that we say, you know, an injury to one is an injury to us all. We are LGBTQ. We're not going to stop being LGBTQ. The T is an absolute integral part of all LGBTQ spaces. Anyone who goes to LGBTQ spaces, trans people obviously have played absolutely incredible roles throughout our history fighting for our rights, including, of course, at the first Stonewall, the Stonewall riot, which gave the name.
And still are.
Exactly. And still are people like Katie. So, you know, trans people have fought for the rights of gay people like myself, cis gay people like myself, and it's our duty and responsibility to do the same and stand by our trans siblings, which we will keep doing despite the failed efforts of these bigots to divide us, which they will never entirely succeed in. I mean, as I say, we do have these problems to deal with, but we will fight and we will win, and we will stand with you to the very end. Lots of love, Katie. Take care, and I will speak to you soon.
Thank you. Thanks a lot for having me.
Yeah. Lots of love. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Oh, hello. I just popped that. You see, my producer's not here today, as I've said, so it's just me doing it. You can see it's been a bit ropey all the way through, so I keep making the guests full screen. Anyway, lots of love. See you in a bit. Thank you so much, everybody. What a range of topics. Blimey. Really covered it. I found it very educational, as ever. I basically do these just to get essentially a private lecture tour from guests, and then, you know, everything else is a bonus. I just want to do a quick thank you to all of our super chats. So we have had David Barata, thank you so much. Gunner Station, Mellow Maggot, love these names. Alexandra Barnes, Gwyneth V. Doherty, L. Trujet, Mark Gorman. Have I said Gwyneth already? Gwyneth V. Doherty, I think I did, yes. Lirianne, who's saying, going to follow Katie on all channels everywhere. Love and solidarity. Lots of hearts. Trans liberation now. Absolutely. Also, Sine Bazu. Thank you so much, everyone, for your support as ever. And we will use the support you give us to create these documentaries. We've got, as I've said, this great documentary looking at how working class communities are well, what, in terms of property development and the power of, well, you'll see what we're going to do with this documentary. It's going to be very, very exciting. And it's giving a the megaphone to working class people, working class communities who are otherwise ignored and marginalized by most media outlets. But it's looking at how this working class community is being ripped apart by property developers. So very much looking forward for that. You supported us. You made the Tory and Labour conference documentaries possible and all the other documentaries that we've done. So thank you for your incredible support, everybody. Just to wrap up. Oh, yeah, I should say I'm speaking in Yeovil in a week's time. Not my natural heartland. I'm going to be honest with you. Labour got about 5% of the vote in Yeovil in the last election. So it's going to be interesting. Will anyone even come? I mean, a couple of people got in touch in Yeovil and were like, interesting choice. But it's the Yeovil Literary Festival. That's where I'm going. So I'm just popping along for that. So if you look up Owen Jones Yeovil, you'll find it. I'm there next Sunday evening, 8 o'clock. So if you are one of the few lefties in Yeovil or not, don't have to be a lefty, do come and say hi. At the Octagon. Cheers everybody for that. I am now gonna go. I feel like a cheeky little Sunday roast, which I'm having later. I hope you're all having just a great Sunday, and thanks to all our guests. As I said, support us on patreon.com/owenjones84. You make this, the documentaries, everything possible. We've got some great interviews coming up. We'll be live again next Sunday. I think that is basically it. I know sometimes I do a rant about something, but to be honest with you, I think we've covered so much that just do your own rant. You don't need my rant. Just have a little 5-minute rant about anything. There's quite a lot to rant about. And I will see you soon. Lots of love, everybody. Take care. Bye-bye. Thanks for listening, everyone. I hope you found that informative, educational, interesting, and I certainly did. Do support us on Patreon to keep the show on the road, /OwenJones84. Leave us some stars, that'd be nice. Spread the word, and I look forward to speaking to you soon.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.